This time he was on the right track, sure. His imagination mill was hard at work in a minute now. Thereafter, during a stretch of 2 exhausting hours, he was busy saving Goodson's life. He saved it in all kinds of difficult and perilous ways. In every case, he got it saved satisfactorily up to a certain point. Then, just as he was beginning to get well persuaded that it had really happened, a troublesome detail would turn up, which made the whole thing impossible. As in the matter of drowning, for instance. In that case, he had swum out and tugged Goodson ashore in an unconscious state, with a great crowd looking on and applauding. But when he had got it all thought out and was just beginning to remember all about it, a whole swarm of disqualifying details arrived on the ground. The town would have known of the circumstance. Mary would have known of it. It would glare like a limelight in his own memory, instead of being an inconspicuous service which he had possibly rendered without knowing its full value. And at this point he remembered that he couldn't swim anyway. Ah, there was a point which he had been overlooking from the start. It had to be a service which he had rendered, possibly without knowing the full value of it. Why, really, that ought to be an easy hunt, much easier than those others. And sure enough, by and by, he found it. Goodson, years and years ago, came near marrying a very sweet and pretty girl named Nancy Hewitt. But in some way or other the match had been broken off. The girl died, Goodson remained a bachelor, and by and by became a soured one, and a frank despiser of the human species. Soon after the girl's death, the village found out, or thought it had found out, that she carried a spoonful of Negro blood in her veins. Richards worked at these details a good while, and in the end he thought he remembered things concerning them which must have gotten mislaid in his memory through long neglect. He seemed to dimly remember that it was he that found out about the Negro blood, that it was he that told the village, that the village told Goodson where they got it, that he thus saved Goodson from marrying the tainted girl, that he had done him this great service without knowing the full value of it, in fact, without knowing that he was doing it, but that Goodson knew the value of it, and what a narrow escape he had had, and so went to his grave, grateful to his benefactor, and wishing he had a fortune to leave him. It was all clear and simple now, and the more he went over it, the more luminous and certain it grew. And at last, when he nestled to sleep, satisfied and happy, he remembered the whole thing, just as if it had been yesterday. In fact, he dimly remembered Goodson's telling him his gratitude once. Meantime, Mary had spent $6,000 on a new house for herself, and a pair of slippers for her pastor, and then had fallen peacefully to rest. That same Saturday evening, the postman had delivered a letter to each of the other principal citizens. 19 letters in all. No 2 of the envelopes were alike, and no 2 of the superscriptions were in the same hand, but the letters inside were just like each other in every detail but one. They were exact copies of the letter received by Richards, handwriting and all, and were all signed by Stevenson, but in place of Richards's name, each receiver's own name appeared. All night long, 18 principal citizens did what their caste brother Richards was doing at the same time. They put in their energies trying to remember what notable service it was that they had unconsciously done Barclay Goodson. In no case was it a holiday job. Still, they succeeded. And while they were at this work, which was difficult, their wives put in the night spending the money, which was easy. During that one night, the 19 wives spent an average of $7,000 each out of the $40,000 in the sack, $133,000 altogether. Next day, there was a surprise for Jack Halliday. He noticed that the faces of the 19 chief citizens and their wives bore that expression of peaceful and holy happiness again. He could not understand it. Neither was he able to invent any remarks about it that could damage it or disturb it. And so it was his turn to be dissatisfied with life. His private guesses at the reasons for the happiness failed in all instances, upon examination. When he met Mrs. Wilcox and noticed the placid ecstasy in her face, he said to himself, "Her cat has had kittens," and went and asked the cook. It was not so. The cook had detected the happiness, but did not know the cause. When Halliday found the duplicate ecstasy in the face of Shadbelly Bilson, village nickname, he was sure some neighbor of Bilson's had broken his leg, but inquiry showed that this had not happened. The subdued ecstasy in Gregory Yates's face could mean but one thing. He was a mother-in-law short. It was another mistake. And Pinkerton? Pinkerton! He has collected 10 cents that he thought he was going to lose. And so on and so on. In some cases the guesses had to remain in doubt. In the others they proved distinct errors. In the end, Halliday said to himself, "Anyway, it foots up that there's 19 Hadleyburg families temporarily in heaven. I don't know how it happened. I only know Providence is off duty today." An architect and builder from the next state had lately ventured to set up a small business in this unpromising village, and his sign had now been hanging out a week. Not a customer yet. He was a discouraged man, and sorry he had come. But his weather changed suddenly now. First one and then another chief citizen's wife said to him privately, "Come to my house Monday week, but say nothing about it for the present. We think of building." He got 11 invitations that day. That night he wrote his daughter and broke off her match with her student. He said she could marry a mile higher than that. Pinkerton, the banker, and 2 or 3 other well-to-do men planned country seats, but waited. That kind don't count their chickens until they are hatched. The Wilsons devised a grand new thing, a fancy dress ball. They made no actual promises, but told all their acquaintanceship in confidence that they were thinking the matter over and thought they should give it. "And if we do, you will be invited, of course." People were surprised and said to one another, "Why, they are crazy, those poor Wilsons. They can't afford it." Several among the 19 said privately to their husbands, "It is a good idea. We will keep still till their cheap thing is over. Then we will give one that will make it sick." The days drifted along, and the bill of future squanderings rose higher and higher, wilder and wilder, more and more foolish and reckless. It began to look as if every member of the 19 would not only spend his whole $40,000 before receiving day, but be actually in debt by the time he got the money. In some cases, light-headed people did not stop with planning to spend. They really spent, on credit. They bought land, mortgages, farms, speculative stocks, fine clothes, horses, and various other things, paid down the bonus, and made themselves liable for the rest, at 10 days. Presently the sober second thought came, and Halliday noticed that a ghastly anxiety was beginning to show up in a good many faces. Again he was puzzled, and didn't know what to make of it. "The Wilcox kittens aren't dead, for they weren't born. Nobody's broken a leg. There's no shrinkage in mother-in-laws. Nothing has happened. It is an insolvable mystery." There was another puzzled man, too, the Reverend Mr. Burgess. For days, wherever he went, people seemed to follow him, or to be watching out for him. And if he ever found himself in a retired spot, a member of the 19 would be sure to appear, thrust an envelope privately into his hand, whisper, "To be opened at the town hall Friday evening," then vanish away like a guilty thing. He was expecting that there might be one claimant for the sack. Doubtful, however, Goodson being dead, but it never occurred to him that all this crowd might be claimants. When the great Friday came at last, he found that he had 19 envelopes.
Chapter 3.
The town hall had never looked finer. The platform at the end of it was backed by a showy draping of flags. At intervals along the walls were festoons of flags. The gallery fronts were clothed in flags. The supporting columns were swathed in flags. All this was to impress the stranger, for he would be there in considerable force, and in a large degree he would be connected with the press. The house was full. The 412 fixed seats were occupied, also the 68 extra chairs which had been packed into the aisles. The steps of the platform were occupied. Some distinguished strangers were given seats on the platform. At the horseshoe of tables, which fenced the front and sides of the platform, sat a strong force of special correspondents, who had come from everywhere. It was the best-dressed house the town had ever produced. There were some tolerably expensive toilettes there, and in several cases the ladies who wore them had the look of being unfamiliar with that kind of clothes. At least the town thought they had that look. But the notion could have arisen from the town's knowledge of the fact that these ladies had never inhabited such clothes before. The gold sack stood on a little table at the front of the platform, where all the house could see it. The bulk of the house gazed at it with a burning interest, a mouth-watering interest, a wistful and pathetic interest. A minority of 19 couples gazed at it tenderly, lovingly, proprietarily. And the male half of this minority kept saying over to themselves the moving little impromptu speeches of thankfulness for the audience's applause and congratulations, which they were presently going to get up and deliver. Every now and then one of these got a piece of paper out of his vest pocket and privately glanced at it to refresh his memory. Of course there was a buzz of conversation going on. There always is. But at last, when the Reverend Mr. Burgess rose and laid his hand on the sack, he could hear his microbes gnaw. The place was so still. He related the curious history of the sack, then went on to speak in warm terms of Hadleyburg's old and well-earned reputation for spotless honesty, and of the town's just pride in this reputation. He said that this reputation was a treasure of priceless value, that under Providence its value had now become inestimably enhanced, for the recent episode had spread this fame far and wide, and thus had focused the eyes of the American world upon this village, and made its name for all time, as he hoped and believed, a synonym for commercial incorruptibility. Applause. "And who is to be the guardian of this noble treasure? The community as a whole? No. The responsibility is individual, not communal. From this day forth, each and every one of you is, in his own person, its special guardian, and individually responsible that no harm shall come to it. Do you, does each of you, accept this great trust?"
Tumultuous assent.
"Then all is well. Transmit it to your children, and to your children's children. Today your purity is beyond reproach. See to it that it shall remain so. Today there is not a person in your community who could be beguiled to touch a penny not his own. See to it that you abide in this grace."
"We will, we will."
"This is not the place to make comparisons between ourselves and other communities. Some of them ungracious toward us. They have their ways, we have ours. Let us be content."
Applause.
"I am done. Under my hand, my friends, rests a stranger's eloquent recognition of what we are. Through him the world will always henceforth know what we are. We do not know who he is, but in your name I utter your gratitude, and ask you to raise your voices in endorsement."
The house rose in a body, and made the walls quake with the thunders of its thankfulness for the space of a long minute. Then it sat down, and Mr. Burgess took an envelope out of his pocket. The house held its breath while he slit the envelope open and took from it a slip of paper. He read its contents, slowly and impressively, the audience listening with tranced attention to this magic document, each of whose words stood for an ingot of gold.
"The remark which I made to the distressed stranger was this. You are very far from being a bad man. Go and reform."
Then he continued, "We shall know in a moment now whether the remark here quoted corresponds with the one concealed in the sack, and if that shall prove to be so, and it undoubtedly will, this sack of gold belongs to a fellow citizen who will henceforth stand before the nation as the symbol of the special virtue which has made our town famous throughout the land, Mr. Billson."
The house had gotten itself all ready to burst into the proper tornado of applause, but instead of doing it, it seemed stricken with a paralysis. There was a deep hush for a moment or two. Then a wave of whispered murmurs swept the place, of about this tenor.
"Billson? Oh, come, this is too thin. $20 to a stranger? Or anybody? Billson? Tell it to the Marines."
And now at this point the house caught its breath all of a sudden in a new access of astonishment, for it discovered that whereas in one part of the hall Deacon Billson was standing up with his head meekly bowed, in another part of it Lawyer Wilson was doing the same. There was a wondering silence now for a while. Everybody was puzzled, and 19 couples were surprised and indignant. Billson and Wilson turned and stared at each other. Billson asked, bitingly,
"Why do you rise, Mr. Wilson?" "Because I have a right to. Perhaps you will be good enough to explain to the house why you rise." "With great pleasure, because I wrote that paper." "It is an impudent falsity. I wrote it myself."
It was Burgess's turn to be paralyzed. He stood looking vacantly at first one of the men and then the other, and did not seem to know what to do. The house was stupefied. Lawyer Wilson spoke up now and said,
"I ask the chair to read the name signed to that paper."
That brought the chair to itself, and it read out the name,
"John Wharton Billson."
"There!"
shouted Billson.
"What have you got to say for yourself now? And what kind of apology are you going to make to me and to this insulted house for the imposture which you have attempted to play here? No apologies are due, sir. And as for the rest of it, I publicly charge you with pilfering my note from Mr. Burgess and substituting a copy of it signed with your own name. There is no other way by which you could have gotten hold of the test remark. I alone of living men possessed the secret of its wording."
There was likely to be a scandalous state of things if this went on. Everybody noticed with distress that the shorthand scribes were scribbling like mad. Many people were crying,
"Chair! Chair! Order! Order!"
Burgess rapped with his gavel and said,
"Let us not forget the proprieties due. There has evidently been a mistake somewhere, but surely that is all. If Mr. Wilson gave me an envelope, and I remember now that he did, I still have it."
He took one out of his pocket, opened it, glanced at it, looked surprised and worried, and stood silent a few moments. Then he waved his hand in a wandering and mechanical way, and made an effort or two to say something, then gave it up, despondently. Several voices cried out,
"Read it! Read it! What is it?"
So he began in a dazed and sleepwalker fashion.
"The remark which I made to the unhappy stranger was this. You are far from being a bad man."
The house gazed at him, marveling.
"Go and reform."
Murmurs.
"Amazing! What can this mean?"
"This one," said the chair, "is signed Thurlow G. Wilson."
"There!" cried Wilson. "I reckon that settles it. I knew perfectly well my note was purloined."
"Purloined!" retorted Billson.
"I'll let you know that neither you nor any man of your kidney must venture to—"
The chair.
Order, gentlemen, order. Take your seats, both of you, please.
They obeyed, shaking their heads and grumbling angrily. The House was profoundly puzzled. It did not know what to do with this curious emergency. Presently Thompson got up. Thompson was the Hatter. He would have liked to be a 19er, but such was not for him. His stock of hats was not considerable enough for the position. He said,
"Mr. Chairman, if I may be permitted to make a suggestion, can both of these gentlemen be right? I put it to you, sir, can both have happened to say the very same words to the stranger? It seems to me..."
The tanner got up and interrupted him. The tanner was a disgruntled man. He believed himself entitled to be a 19er, but he couldn't get recognition. It made him a little unpleasant in his ways and speech. Said he,
"Sure, that's not the point. That could happen, 20 in 100 years, but not the other thing. Neither of them gave the $20.
A ripple of applause. Bilson,
"I did."
Wilson,
"I did."
Then each accused the other of pilfering. The chair,
"Order, sit down, if you please, both of you. Neither of the notes has been out of my possession at any moment."
A voice,
"Good, that settles that."
The tanner,
"Mr. Chairman, one thing is now plain. One of these men has been eavesdropping under the other one's bed, and filching family secrets. If it is not unparliamentary to suggest it, I will remark that both are equal to it."
The chair,
"Order, order." "I withdraw the remark, sir, and will confine myself to suggesting that if one of them has overheard the other reveal the test remark to his wife, we shall catch him now."
A voice,
"How?"
The tanner,
"Easily. The two have not quoted the remark in exactly the same words. You would have noticed that if there hadn't been a considerable stretch of time and an exciting quarrel inserted between the two readings."
A voice,
"Name the difference."
The tanner,
"The word very is in Bilson's note, and not in the other."
Many voices,
"That's so. He's right."
The tanner,
"And so, if the chair will examine the test remark in the sack, we shall know which of these two frauds..."
The chair,
"Order." "Which of these two adventurers..."
The chair,
"Order, order." "Which of these two gentlemen..."
Laughter and applause.
"Is entitled to wear the belt as being the first dishonest blatherskite ever bred in this town, which he has dishonored, and which will be a sultry place for him from now out."
Vigorous applause. Many voices,
"Open it! Open the sack!"
Mr. Burgess made a slit in the sack, slid his hand in, and brought out an envelope. In it were a couple of folded notes. He said,
"One of these is marked, not to be examined until all written communications which have been addressed to the chair, if any, shall have been read. The other is marked, the test. Allow me. It is worded, to wit, I do not require that the first half of the remark which was made to me by my benefactor shall be quoted with exactness, for it was not striking and could be forgotten. But its closing 15 words are quite striking, and I think easily rememberable. Unless these shall be accurately reproduced, let the applicant be regarded as an impostor. My benefactor began by saying he seldom gave advice to anyone, but that it always bore the hallmark of high value when he did give it. Then he said this, and it has never faded from my memory. You are far from being a bad man."
50 voices.
"That settles it. The money's Wilson's. Wilson, Wilson, speech, speech."
People jumped up and crowded around Wilson, wringing his hand and congratulating fervently. Meantime the chair was hammering with the gavel and shouting,
"Order, gentlemen, order, order! Let me finish reading, please."
When quiet was restored, the reading was resumed, as follows.
"Go and reform, or mark my words, some day for your sins you will die and go to hell, or Hadleyburg. Try and make it the former."
A ghastly silence followed. First an angry cloud began to settle darkly upon the faces of the citizenship. After a pause, the cloud began to rise, and a tickled expression tried to take its place, tried so hard that it was only kept under with great and painful difficulty. The reporters, the Brixtonites, and other strangers bent their heads down and shielded their faces with their hands, and managed to hold in by main strength and heroic courtesy. At this most inopportune time burst upon the stillness the roar of a solitary voice, Jack Halliday's.
"That's got the hallmark on it."
Then the house let go, strangers and all. Even Mr. Burgess's gravity broke down presently. Then the audience considered itself officially absolved from all restraint, and it made the most of its privilege. It was a good long laugh, and a tempestuously whole-hearted one. But it ceased at last, long enough for Mr. Burgess to try to resume, and for the people to get their eyes partially wiped. Then it broke out again, and afterward yet again. Then at last Burgess was able to get out these serious words.
"It is useless to try to disguise the fact. We find ourselves in the presence of a matter of grave import. It involves the honor of your town. It strikes at the town's good name. The difference of a single word between the test remarks offered by Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bilson was itself a serious thing, since it indicated that one or the other of these gentlemen had committed a theft."
The two men were sitting limp, nerveless, crushed, but at these words both were electrified into movement and started to get up.
"Sit down," said the chair sharply, and they obeyed. That, as I have said, was a serious thing, and it was, but for only one of them. But the matter has become graver, for the honor of both is now in formidable peril. Shall I go even further and say, in inextricable peril? Both left out the crucial 15 words."
He paused. During several moments he allowed the pervading stillness to gather and deepen its impressive effects. Then added,
"There would seem to be but one way whereby this could happen. I ask these gentlemen, was there collusion? Agreement?"
A low murmur sifted through the house. Its import was,
"He's got them both."
Bilson was not used to emergencies. He sat in a helpless collapse. But Wilson was a lawyer. He struggled to his feet, pale and worried, and said,
"I ask the indulgence of the house while I explain this most painful matter. I am sorry to say what I am about to say, since it must inflict irreparable injury upon Mr. Bilson, whom I have always esteemed and respected until now, and in whose invulnerability to temptation I entirely believed, as did you all. But for the preservation of my own honor I must speak, and with frankness. I confess with shame, and I now beseech your pardon for it, that I said to the ruined stranger all of the words contained in the test remark, including the disparaging 15.
Sensation.
When the late publication was made, I recalled them, and I resolved to claim the sack of coin, for by every right I was entitled to it. Now I will ask you to consider this point, and weigh it well. That stranger's gratitude to me that night knew no bounds. He said himself that he could find no words for it that were adequate, and that if he should ever be able, he would repay me a thousandfold. Now then, I ask you this. Could I expect, could I believe, could I even remotely imagine that, feeling as he did, he would do so ungrateful a thing as to add those quite unnecessary 15 words to his test? Set a trap for me? Expose me as a slanderer of my own town before my own people assembled in a public hall? It was preposterous. It was impossible. His test would contain only the kindly opening clause of my remark. Of that I had no shadow of doubt. You would have thought as I did. You would not have expected a base betrayal from one whom you had befriended, and against whom you had committed no offense. And so, with perfect confidence, perfect trust, I wrote on a piece of paper the opening words, ending with "Go and reform," and signed it. When I was about to put it in an envelope, I was called into my back office, and without thinking, I left the paper lying open on my desk.
He stopped, turned his head slowly toward Bilson, waited a moment, then added,
"I ask you to note this. When I returned a little later, Mr. Bilson was retiring by my street door."
Sensation. In a moment, Bilson was on his feet and shouting,
"It's a lie! It's an infamous lie!"
The chair,
"Be seated, sir. Mr. Wilson has the floor."
Bilson's friends pulled him into his seat and quieted him, and Wilson went on,
"Those are the simple facts. My note was now lying in a different place on the table from where I had left it. I noticed that, but attached no importance to it, thinking a draft had blown it there. That Mr. Bilson would read a private paper was a thing which could not occur to me. He was an honorable man, and he would be above that. If you will allow me to say it, I think his extra word 'very' stands explained. It is attributable to a defective memory. I was the only man in the world who could furnish here any detail of the test mark, by honorable means. I have finished."
There is nothing in the world like a persuasive speech to fuddle the mental apparatus and upset the convictions and debauch the emotions of an audience not practiced in the tricks and delusions of oratory. Wilson sat down victorious. The house submerged him in tides of approving applause. Friends swarmed to him and shook him by the hand and congratulated him, and Bilson was shouted down and not allowed to say a word. The chair hammered and hammered with its gavel and kept shouting,
"But let us proceed, gentlemen, let us proceed."
At last there was a measurable degree of quiet, and the Hatter said,
"But what is there to proceed with, sir, but to deliver the money?"
Voices.
"That's it, that's it. Come forward, Wilson."
The Hatter.
"I move three cheers for Mr. Wilson, symbol of the special virtue which—"
The cheers burst forth before he could finish, and in the midst of them, and in the midst of the clamor of the gavel also, some enthusiasts mounted Wilson on a big friend's shoulder, and were going to fetch him in triumph to the platform. The chair's voice now rose above the noise.
"Order! To your places! You forget that there is still a document to be read."
When quiet had been restored, he took up the document, and was going to read it, but laid it down again, saying,
"I forgot. This is not to be read until all written communications received by me have first been read."
He took an envelope out of his pocket, removed its enclosure, glanced at it, seemed astonished, held it out and gazed at it, stared at it. 20 or 30 voices cried out,
"What is it? Read it! Read it!"
And he did, slowly and wondering. "The remark which I made to the stranger—" Voices.
"Hello, how's this?"
"Was this. You are far from being a bad man." Voices.
"Great Scott!"
"Go and reform." Voice.
"Oh, saw my leg off."
"Signed by Mr. Pinkerton, the banker." The pandemonium of delight which turned itself loose now was of a sort to make the judicious weep. Those whose withers were unwrung laughed till the tears ran down. The reporters, in throes of laughter, set down disordered pothooks, which would never in the world be decipherable, and a sleeping dog jumped up, scared out of its wits, and barked itself crazy at the turmoil. All manner of cries were scattered through the din.
"We're getting rich! 2 symbols of incorruptibility, without counting Bilson." "3! Count Chadbelly in. We can't have too many." "All right, Bilson's elected." "Alas, poor Wilson, victim of 2 thieves."
A powerful voice.
"Silence! The chair's fished up something more out of its pocket."
Voices.
"Hurrah! Is it something fresh? Read it! Read, read!"
The chair, reading. "The remark which I made, etc. You are far from being a bad man. Go, etc. Signed, Gregory Yates." Tornado of voices.
4 symbols! Rah for Yates! Fish again!"
The house was in a roaring humor now, and ready to get all the fun out of the occasion that might be in it. Several 19ers, looking pale and distressed, got up, and began to work their way toward the aisles, but a score of shouts went up.
"The doors! The doors! Close the doors! No incorruptible shall leave this place! Sit down, everybody!"
The mandate was obeyed.
"Fish again! Read! Read!"
The chair fished again, and once more the familiar words began to fall from its lips.
"You are far from being a bad man."
"Name! Name! What's his name?"
"L. Inglesby Sargent."
"Five elected! Pile up the symbols! Go on, go on!"
"You are far from being a bad..."
"Name, name!"
"Nicholas Whitworth."
"Hooray, hooray! It's a symbolical day!"
Somebody wailed in and began to sing this rhyme, leaving out "its," to the lovely Mikado tune of "When a man's afraid of a beautiful maid." The audience joined in with joy. Then, just in time, somebody contributed another line.
"And don't you this forget!"
The house roared it out. A third line was at once furnished.
"Corruptibles far from Hadleyburg are!"
The house roared that one, too. As the last note died, Jack Halliday's voice rose high and clear, freighted with a final line.
"But the cymbals are here, you bet!"
That was sung with booming enthusiasm. Then the happy house started in at the beginning and sang the four lines through twice with immense swing and dash, and finished up with a crashing 3x3 and a tiger for
"Hadleyburg the Incorruptible and all symbols of it which we shall find worthy to receive the hallmark tonight."
Then the shoutings at the chair began again all over the place.
"Go on, go on, read! Read some more! Read all you've got! That's it, go on! We are winning eternal celebrity!"
A dozen men got up now and began to protest. They said that this farce was the work of some abandoned joker, and was an insult to the whole community. Without a doubt, these signatures were all forgeries.
"Sit down, sit down! Shut up! You are confessing! We'll find your names in the lot. Mr. Chairman, how many of those envelopes have you got?"
The chair counted. "Together with those that have been already examined, there are 19. A storm of derisive applause broke out.
"Perhaps they all contain the secret. I move that you open them all and read every signature that is attached to a note of that sort, and read also the first 8 words of the note."
"Second the motion."
It was put and carried, uproariously. Then poor old Richards got up, and his wife rose and stood at his side. Her head was bent down, so that none might see that she was crying. Her husband gave her his arm, and so, supporting her, he began to speak in a quavering voice.
"My friends, you have known us too, Mary and me, all our lives, and I think you have liked us and respected us."
The chair interrupted him.
"Allow me. It is quite true, that which you are saying, Mr. Richards. This town does know you, too. It does like you. It does respect you. More, it honors you and loves you."
Halliday's voice rang out.
"That's the hallmarked truth, too. If the chair is right, let the house speak up and say it. Rise! Now then, hip, 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 all together!"
The house rose in mass, faced toward the old couple eagerly, filled the air with a snowstorm of waving handkerchiefs, and delivered the cheers with all its affectionate heart. The chair then continued,
"What I was going to say is this. We know your good heart, Mr. Richards, but this is not a time for the exercise of charity toward offenders."
Shouts of,
"Right, right!"
"I see your generous purpose in your face, but I cannot allow you to plead for these men."
"But I was going to..."
"Please take your seat, Mr. Richards. We must examine the rest of these notes. Simple fairness to the men who have already been exposed requires this. As soon as that has been done, I give you my word for this, you shall be heard."
Many voices.
"Right! The chair is right! No interruption can be permitted at this stage. Go on! The names, the names! According to the terms of the motion!"
The old couple sat reluctantly down, and the husband whispered to the wife,
"It is pitifully hard to have to wait. The shame will be greater than ever when they find we were only going to plead for ourselves."
Straightway the jollity broke loose again with the reading of the names.
"You are far from being a bad man. Signature, Robert J. Titmarsh." "You are far from being a bad man. Signature, Eliphalet Weeks."
You are far from being a bad man. Signature, Oscar B. Wilder.
At this point the House lit upon the idea of taking the 8 words out of the chairman's hands. He was not unthankful for that. Thenceforward he held up each note in its turn and waited. The House droned out the 8 words in a massed and measured and musical deep volume of sound, with a daringly close resemblance to a well-known church chant.
You are far from being a bad man.
Then the chair said,
Signature, Archibald Wilcox.
And so on, name after name, and everybody had an increasingly and gloriously good time, except the wretched 19. Now and then, when a particularly shining name was called, the House made the chair wait while it chanted the whole of the test remark, from the beginning to the closing words,
And go to hell or Hadleyburg, try and make it the former.
And in these special cases they added a grand and agonized and imposing
Amen.
The list dwindled, dwindled, dwindled. Poor old Richards keeping tally of the count, wincing when a name resembling his own was pronounced, and waiting in miserable suspense for the time to come when it would be his humiliating privilege to rise with Mary and finish his plea, which he was intending to word thus,
For until now we have never done anything wrong, but have gone our humble way unreproached. We are very poor, we are old, and have no chick nor child to help us. We were sorely tempted, and we fell. It was my purpose when I got up before to make confession, and beg that my name might not be read out in this public place, for it seemed to us that we could not bear it. But I was prevented. It was just. It was our place to suffer with the rest. It has been hard for us. It is the first time we have ever heard our name fall from anyone's lips, sullied. Be merciful, for the sake of the better days. Make our shame as light to bear as in your charity you can.
At this point in his reverie, Mary nudged him, perceiving that his mind was absent. The House was chanting,
You are far,
etc.
Be ready, Mary whispered. Your name comes now. He has read 18.
The chant ended.
Next, next, next,
came volleying from all over the House. Burgess put his hand into his pocket. The old couple, trembling, began to rise. Burgess fumbled a moment, then said,
I find I have read them all.
Faint with joy and surprise, the couple sank into their seats, and Mary whispered,
Oh, bless God, we are saved! He has lost ours! I wouldn't give this for 100 of those sacks.
The House burst out with its Mikado travesty and sang it 3 times with ever-increasing enthusiasm, rising to its feet when it reached for the 3rd time the closing line,
But the symbols are here, you bet!
And finishing up with cheers and a tiger for
Hadleyburg purity and our 18 immortal representatives of it!
Then Wingate, the saddler, got up and proposed cheers
for the cleanest man in town, the one solitary important citizen in it who didn't try to steal that money, Edward Richards!
They were given with great and moving heartiness. Then somebody proposed that Richards be elected sole guardian and symbol of the now sacred Hadleyburg tradition, with power and right to stand up and look the whole sarcastic world in the face. Passed by acclamation. Then they sang the Mikado again, and ended it with,
And there's one symbol left, you bet.
There was a pause. Then a voice.
Well, now then, who's to get the sack?
The tanner, with bitter sarcasm.
That's easy. The money has to be divided among the 18 incorruptibles. They gave the suffering stranger $20 apiece, and that remark, each in his turn. It took 22 minutes for the procession to move past. Staked the stranger, total contribution $360. All they want is just the loan back.
and interest, $40,000 altogether.
Many voices derisively.
That's it! Divvy! Divvy! Be kind to the poor! Don't keep them waiting!
The chair.
Order! I now offer the stranger's remaining document. It says, if no claimant shall appear,
grand chorus of groans,
I desire that you open the sack and count out the money to the principal citizens of your town, they to take it in trust.
Cries of oh, oh, oh.
And use it in such ways as to them shall seem best for the propagation and preservation of your community's noble reputation for incorruptible honesty.
More cries.
A reputation to which their names and their efforts will add a new and far-reaching luster.
Enthusiastic outburst of sarcastic applause.
That seems to be all. No, here is a postscript.
P.S. Citizens of Hadleyburg, there is no test remark. Nobody made one. Great sensation.
There wasn't any pauper stranger, nor any $20 contribution, nor any accompanying benediction and compliment. These are all inventions.
General buzz and hum of astonishment and delight.
Allow me to tell my story. It will take but a word or two. I passed through your town at a certain time and received a deep offense which I had not earned. Any other man would have been content to kill one or two of you and call it square. But to me that would have been a trivial revenge and inadequate, for the dead do not suffer. Besides, I could not kill you all, and anyway, made as I am, even that would not have satisfied me. I wanted to damage every man in the place and every woman, and not in their bodies or in their estate, but in their vanity, the place where feeble and foolish people are most vulnerable. So I disguised myself and came back and studied you. You were easy game. You had an old and lofty reputation for honesty, and naturally you were proud of it. It was your treasure of treasures, the very apple of your eye. As soon as I found out that you carefully and vigilantly kept yourselves and your children out of temptation, I knew how to proceed. Why, you simple creatures, the weakest of all weak things is a virtue which has not been tested in the fire. I laid a plan, and gathered a list of names. My project was to corrupt Hadleyburg the incorruptible. My idea was to make liars and thieves of nearly half a hundred smirchless men and women who had never in their lives uttered a lie or stolen a penny. I was afraid of Goodson. He was neither born nor reared in Hadleyburg. I was afraid that if I started to operate my scheme by getting my letter laid before you, you would say to yourselves, Goodson is the only man among us who would give away $20 to a poor devil, and then you might not bite at my bait. But heaven took Goodson. Then I knew I was safe, and I set my trap and baited it. It may be that I shall not catch all the men to whom I mailed the pretended test secret, but I shall catch the most of them if I know Hadleyburg nature.
Voices.
Right. He got every last one of them. I believe they will even steal ostensible gamble money rather than miss. Poor tempted and mistrained fellows. I am hoping to eternally and everlastingly squelch your vanity and give Hadleyburg a new renown, one that will stick and spread far. If I have succeeded, open the sack and summon the Committee on Propagation and Preservation of the Hadleyburg Reputation.
A cyclone of voices.
Open it! Open it! The 18 to the front! Committee on Propagation of the Tradition! Forward, the incorruptibles!
The chair ripped the sack wide and gathered up a handful of bright, broad yellow coins, shook them together, then examined them.
Friends, they are only gilded discs of lead!
There was a crashing outbreak of delight over this news, and when the noise had subsided, the tanner called out,
By right of apparent seniority in this business, Mr. Wilson is chairman of the Committee on Propagation of the Tradition. I suggest that he step forward on behalf of his pals and receive in trust the money.
100 voices.
"Wilson! Wilson! Wilson! Speech! Speech!"
Wilson, in a voice trembling with anger,
"You will allow me to say, and without apologies for my language, damn the money!"
A voice.
"Oh, and him a Baptist!"
A voice.
17 symbols left! Step up, gentlemen, and assume your trust!"
There was a pause. No response. The saddler.
"Mr. Chairman, we've got one clean man left anyway out of the late aristocracy, and he needs money and deserves it. I move that you appoint Jack Halliday to get up there and auction off that sack of gilt $20 pieces and give the result to the right man, the man whom Hadleyburg delights to honor, Edward Richards."
This was received with great enthusiasm, the dog taking a hand again. The saddler started the bids at $1. The Brixton folk and Barnum's representative fought hard for it. The people cheered every jump that the bids made. The excitement climbed moment by moment higher and higher. The bidders got on their mettle and grew steadily more and more daring, more and more determined. The jumps went from $1 up to 5, then to 10, then to 20, then 50, then to 100, then... At the beginning of the auction, Richards whispered in distress to his wife,
"Oh, Mary, can we allow it? You see, it is an honor reward, a testimonial to purity of character, and can we allow it? Hadn't I better get up and... Oh, Mary, what ought we to do? What do you think we..."
Halliday's voice.
15 I'm bid. 15 for the sack. 20. Ah, thanks. 30. Thanks again. 30, 30, 30. Do I hear 40? 40 it is. Keep the ball rolling, gentlemen. Keep it rolling. 50. Thanks, noble Roman. Going at 50, 50, 50. 70. 90. Splendid. 100. Pile it up. Pile it up. 120. 40. Just in time. 150. 200. Superb. Do I hear 200? Thanks, 250.
It is another temptation, Edward. I'm all in a tremble. But, oh, we've escaped one temptation, and that ought to warn us to...
6, did I hear? Thanks. 650. 700.
And yet, Edward, when you think, nobody suspects...
$800. Hurrah! Make it 9. Mr. Parsons, did I hear you say, thanks, 9. This noble sack of virgin lead going at only $900, gilding it all. Come, do I hear? 1,000, gratefully yours. Did someone say 11? A sack which is going to be the most celebrated in the whole universe.
Oh, Edward, beginning to sob, we are so poor. But do as you think best. Do as you think best.
Edward fell. That is, he sat still. Sat with a conscience which was not satisfied, but which was overpowered by circumstances. Meantime, a stranger, who looked like an amateur detective gotten up as an impossible English earl, had been watching the evening's proceedings with manifest interest, and with a contented expression in his face, and he had been privately commenting to himself. He was now soliloquizing somewhat like this. None of the 18 are bidding. That is not satisfactory. I must change that. The dramatic unities require it. They must buy the sack they tried to steal. They must pay a heavy price, too. Some of them are rich. And another thing, when I make a mistake in Hadleyburg nature, the man that puts that error upon me is entitled to a high honorarium, and someone must pay it. This poor old Richards has brought my judgment to shame. He is an honest man. I don't understand it, but I acknowledge it. Yes, he saw my deuce's and with a straight flush, and by rights the pot is his. And it shall be a jackpot, too, if I can manage it. He disappointed me, but let that pass. He was watching the bidding. At 1,000 the market broke, the prices tumbled swiftly. He waited, and still watched. One competitor dropped out, then another, and another. He put in a bid or two now. When the bids had sunk to $10, he added a 5, someone raised him a 3, He waited a moment, then flung in a $50 jump, and the sack was his. At $1,282, the house broke out in cheers, then stopped, for he was on his feet and had lifted his hand. He began to speak.
"I desire to say a word and ask a favor. I am a speculator in rarities, and I have dealings with persons interested in numismatics all over the world. I can make a profit on this purchase, just as it stands, but there is a way, if I can get your approval, whereby I can make every one of these leaden $20 pieces worth its face in gold, and perhaps more. Grant me that approval, and I will give part of my gains to your Mr. Richards, whose invulnerable probity you have so justly and so cordially recognized tonight. His share shall be $10,000, and I will hand him the money tomorrow."
Great applause from the house, but the invulnerable probity made the Richardses blush prettily. However, it went for modesty and did no harm.
"If you will pass my proposition by a good majority, I would like a 2/3 vote. I will regard that as the town's consent, and that is all I ask. Rarities are always helped by any device which will rouse curiosity and compel remark. Now, if I may have your permission to stamp upon the faces of each of these ostensible coins the names of the 18 gentlemen who—"
9/10 of the audience were on their feet in a moment, dog and all, and the proposition was carried with a whirlwind of approving applause and laughter. They sat down, and all the symbols, except Dr. Clay Harkness, got up, violently protesting against the proposed outrage, and threatening to—
"I beg you not to threaten me," said the stranger calmly. "I know my legal rights, and am not accustomed to being frightened at bluster."
Applause. He sat down. Dr. Harkness saw an opportunity here. He was one of the two very rich men of the place, and Pinkerton was the other. Harkness was proprietor of a mint, that is to say, a popular patent medicine. He was running for the legislature on one ticket, and Pinkerton on the other. It was a close race, and a hot one, and getting hotter every day. Both had strong appetites for money. Each had bought a great tract of land with a purpose. There was going to be a new railway, and each wanted to be in the legislature and help locate the route to his own advantage. A single vote might make the decision, and with it two or three fortunes. The stake was large, and Harkness was a daring speculator. He was sitting close to the stranger. He leaned over while one or another of the other symbols was entertaining the house with protests and appeals, and asked, in a whisper,
"What is your price for the sack?"
$40,000.
"I'll give you 20.
"No."
"25.
"No."
"Say 30.
"The price is $40,000, not a penny less."
"All right, I'll give it. I will come to the hotel at 10 in the morning. I don't want it known. We'll see you privately."
"Very good."
Then the stranger got up and said to the house,
"I find it late. The speeches of these gentlemen are not without merit, not without interest, not without grace. Yet, if I may be excused, I will take my leave. I thank you for the great favor which you have shown me in granting my petition. I ask the chair to keep the sack for me until tomorrow, and to hand these 3 $500 notes to Mr. Richards."
They were passed up to the chair.
"At 9 I will call for the sack, and at 11 will deliver the rest of the 10,000 to Mr. Richards in person at his home. Good night."
Then he slipped out, and left the audience making a vast noise, which was composed of a mixture of cheers, the Mikado song, dog disapproval, and the chant,
"You are far from being a bad man. Amen."
Chapter 4. At home, the Richardses had to endure congratulations and compliments until midnight. Then they were left to themselves. They looked a little sad, and they sat silent and thinking. Finally Mary sighed and said,
"Do you think we are to blame, Edward? Much to blame?"
And her eyes wandered to the accusing triplet of big banknotes lying on the table, where the congratulators had been gloating over them and reverently fingering them. Edward did not answer at once. Then he brought out a sigh and said hesitatingly,
We couldn't help it, Mary. It was ordered. All things are."
Mary glanced up and looked at him steadily, but he didn't return the look. Presently she said,
"I thought congratulations and praises always tasted good, but it seems to me now, Edward..."
"Well?"
"Are you going to stay in the bank?"
"No."
"Resign?"
"In the morning, by note."
"It does seem best."
Richards bowed his head in his hands and muttered,
"Before I was not afraid to let oceans of people's money pour through my hands, but, Mary, I am so tired, so tired."
"We will go to bed."
At 9 in the morning the stranger called for the sack and took it to the hotel in a cab. At 10 Harkness had a talk with him privately. The stranger asked for and got 5 checks on a Metropolitan Bank, drawn to Bearer, 4 for $1,500 each, and 1 for $34,000. He put one of the former in his pocketbook, and the remainder, representing $38,500, he put in an envelope, and with these he added a note, which he wrote after Harkness was gone. At 11 he called at the Richards house and knocked. Mrs. Richards peeped through the shutters, then went and received the envelope, and the stranger disappeared without a word. She came back flushed and a little unsteady on her legs, and gasped out,
"I am sure I recognized him. Last night it seemed to me that maybe I had seen him somewhere before."
"He is the man that brought the sack here?"
"I am almost sure of it."
"Then he is the ostensible Stevenson, too, and sold every important citizen in this town with his bogus secret. Now if he has sent checks instead of money, we are sold, too, after we thought we had escaped. I was beginning to feel fairly comfortable once more after my night's rest, but the look of that envelope makes me sick. It isn't fat enough. $8,500 and even the largest banknotes makes more bulk than that."
"Edward, why do you object to checks?"
"Checks signed by Stevenson. I am resigned to take the $8,500 if it could come in banknotes, for it does seem that it was so ordered, Mary. But I have never had much courage, and I have not the pluck to try to market a check signed with that disastrous name. It would be a trap. That man tried to catch me, and we escaped somehow or other. And now he is trying a new way. If it is checks..."
"Oh, Edward, it is too bad."
And she held up the checks and began to cry.
"Put them in the fire, quick. We mustn't be tempted. It is a trick to make the world laugh at us along with the rest, and give them to me, since you can't do it."
He snatched them and tried to hold his grip till he could get to the stove. But he was human. He was a cashier. And he stopped a moment to make sure of the signature. Then he came near to fainting.
"Fan me, Mary, fan me. They are the same as gold."
"Oh, how lovely, Edward. Why?"
"Signed by Harkness. What can the mystery of that be, Mary?"
"Well, Edward, do you think..."
"Look here, look at this. 15, 15, 15, 34... 38,500! Mary, the sack isn't worth $12, and Harkness, apparently, has paid about par for it."
"And does it all come to us, do you think, instead of the 10,000?
"Why, it looks like it. And the checks are made to Bearer, too."
"Is that good, Edward? What is it for?"
"A hint to collect them at some distant bank, I reckon. Perhaps Harkness doesn't want the matter known. What is that, a note?"
"Yes, it was with the checks."
It was in the Stevenson handwriting, but there was no signature. It said,
"I am a disappointed man. Your honesty is beyond the reach of temptation. I had a different idea about it, but I wronged you in that, and I beg pardon, and do it sincerely. I honor you, and that is sincere, too. This town is not worthy to kiss the hem of your garment. Dear sir, I made a square bet with myself that there were 19 debauchable men in your self-righteous community. I have lost. Take the whole pot. You are entitled to it."
Richards drew a deep sigh and said,
"It seems written with fire. It burns so. Mary, I am miserable again."
"I too. Ah, dear, I wish—"
"To think, Mary, he believes in me."
"Oh, don't, Edward. I can't bear it."
"If those beautiful words were deserved, Mary, and God knows I believed I deserved them once, I think I could give the $40,000 for them. And I would put that paper away as representing more than gold and jewels, and keep it always. But now, we could not live in the shadow of its accusing presence, Mary."
He put it in the fire. A messenger arrived, and delivered an envelope. Richards took from it a note and read it. It was from Burgess.
"You saved me in a difficult time. I saved you last night. It was at cost of a lie, but I made the sacrifice freely and out of a grateful heart. None in this village knows so well as I know how brave and good and noble you are. At bottom you cannot respect me, knowing as you do of that matter of which I am accused, and by the general voice condemned. But I beg that you will at least believe that I